Okay. Let's go ahead and get started. I see a lot of people standing up. I still see some empty seats. Please raise your hand if you have an empty seat next to you so that others might want to come and join you instead of standing up or sitting on the floor. Plenty of seats. All right. So what a fantastic crowd. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Good morning to all of you. Let's go ahead and get started. I've got a lot of content for you on Exchange 2010 High Availability. I also have this Zune HD that has the Exchange Server 2010 logo on the back of it. I'm not giving this away. I just like telling people I have one. So now you know. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team. Among other things, I write the product documentation for high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery, some virtualization stuff with Jeff, and a few other areas as well. And of course, I'm always excited to be at any tech ed anywhere around the world talking about high availability for Exchange 2010. But even as I say that, you really are my favorite audience, so I'm here really just for you. We do have a lot of stuff to talk about. Some of the stuff is not really related completely to the deep dive stuff, but since we introduced some update roll-ups, I wanted to mention briefly some of the code changes and functionality changes that we introduced in those roll-ups so that you understand some of the new behaviors that you might be seeing as you apply them. So we'll talk about those first. Let's talk about some of them you may be aware of, because I know Jeff also talked about some of them as well. So one of the changes that we've introduced is this feature known as cross-site silent redirection with Outlook Web App. So my mailbox is located in Redmond, and I travel all around the world. And if I happen to access a client access server that is not in Redmond, from my mailbox's site perspective, that is the wrong AD site to be in, the wrong CAS server. So one of two things happens. If I have the external URL populated, I'm going to get redirected somewhere. If we don't, we have it proxied. The behavior change is when you have that external URL redirection in place. The user gets a message. It says you'd get better experience if you click this link instead, and they click that link, and they log on again, and finally they're in their mailbox. So what we've done in this update is we've removed the need to click that link. And in some scenarios, if you're using forms-based authentication, that also gives you the side effect of this single sign-on as well. So it removes both the need to click the link and the need to re-enter your credentials. So that's a huge improvement, but when we're talking about that kind of redirection, we're only specifically talking about the kind of redirection that occurs when you're talking to a CAS server that's not in the same AD site as your mailbox server. Has nothing whatsoever to do with the legacy namespace redirection that we do that's also silent when you're moving from 2003 or 2007 to 2010. That's a different kind of silent redirection. This is for cross-site database star over events when a database moves between sites. So that's one big change. And you can see the documentation, and Ross Smith, who's been shepherding that feature, also did a great video on it as well. We also introduced some changes into the set database availability group commandlet as well. And there's two significant changes that we recently introduced. One is we enabled a property that up until now had been reserved for future use. If you read the documentation and you look at the commandlet help, you'll see that every once in a while you'll encounter some parameter that's there in the commandlet, exposed in the shell, but there's a little note there that says it's reserved for future use. Typically, what that note means is that part of the code is in there. The part that reflects that parameter is part of the commandlet. The part that puts that parameter as being available as part of the commandlet. But there's no code that actually exercised what that parameter does. In other words, you could change its value all day and night, and it would not take effect whatsoever. So what we did in update rollup 3 is we've had this property. It's actually a holdover from a feature that we've been trying to get in for some time. So that's why it was reserved for future use. We finally completed that work. Now this property can be used, and depending on its value, which can be either true or false, it will now control whether or not you get cross-site communication or if the end user is going to be sent over to another site because you blocked cross-site RPC communication. Another change that we made, and this is a relatively minor one, this is more cosmetic than anything, it was more an annoying irritation, And that is, there's a couple properties of every DAG, one called the alternate witness server and the other called the alternate witness directory. Those two properties are used only as part of a data center switchover. And the bug that we had was if you set those properties to anything and you wanted to wipe them out and set them back to null, you could not. There was no way to do that in either of our interfaces. If you really, really wanted to do it, you could go into ATSI Edit and wipe out the information, but we weren't telling people to do that. And largely, it doesn't cause any harm to keep stale entries in there. Just be aware that they need to be changed when you're doing the actual switchover. But now we are allowing you to do those kinds of things as well. Remove those properties, set them back to null if you need to. And again, documentation. It says to be published very soon. It's actually being staged right now, so it could be up there later today. And the last change I want to talk about in Update Rollup 3 is this change that we made to Active Manager. And if you're not familiar with Active Manager, by the time you leave this room, you will know it intimately. But there were some changes where we have this functionality inside of Exchange that we've had since 2007. It's called dial tone portability. So the idea is you lose your production database and you make a quick configuration change to move all of those users who had mailbox on that database over to a new empty database called a dial tone database, hence the service metaphor. What we found, though, is that if the source or the target is down, in other words, the old database versus the new database, if they were down while you were trying to do this dial tone portability, it would take forever. Usually it should only take about 2 seconds to move the configuration change because we're not moving any data. We're just flipping some bits in Active Directory, changing a path and a server name, if you will. But because of the RPC activity that Active Manager was doing, that was causing excessive timeouts. And it was going through serially for every mailbox that was being moved on that database. So if you had 100 mailboxes, it was bad. If you had 1,000, it was worse. If you had 10,000, it was much worse. So we actually went in, and now what we do is we know when those exceptions are happening. We know when the code is encountering a situation where the source or the target is not available. And so we've removed the RPC retries that we had in there. And so that basically ignores the exception and keeps going and doesn't wait for the RPC timeout to occur anymore. So if you've been using database portability with Exchange 2010 and you've noticed this phenomenon, once you introduce Update Rollup 3, life is much, much better for you, and you won't be suffering with that anymore. Now, the session I'm about to present is a high availability deep dive. A couple things you want to know about that. It is a 400-level session. There are things that we're going to be talking about that are perhaps even way more advanced than you need to know in terms of day-to-day operations of a DAG or mailbox database copies. But there are also underlying concepts that you'll need to understand. And I know I've already talked to some of you this week who have not had a chance to brush up or see a session on those concepts. Well, I've done sessions on those before, so I would strongly recommend that you go to that link and view the session. This will take you to the most recent one I delivered, which was at TechEd Australia a few months ago. But this will give you the concepts, the underlying basic knowledge that all of you will need to know to be successful with your DAGs. In the concept session, we talk about quorum, witness, witness server, alternate witness server, and a few other things like auto database mount dial, activation preference, and so forth. If you're not familiar with those terms, I'm going to use some of them today, and I will try to explain them. But again, there is sort of this baseline prerequisite knowledge that I want you to have before you start leveraging the advanced knowledge that you're going to get. And quite frankly, not a lot of the advanced knowledge that you're going to get is largely actionable. It's not like the concepts or the tips and tricks where you can go back to your office and start doing things right away. This is more thing to, you know, to think about it, to impress your friends at parties, that kind of stuff. So get your geek on. Okay, so in terms of the HA stuff, and it looks like they scrubbed my agenda slide, or actually, my bad, I whipped right by. In terms of the HA stuff, even though it's a deep dive, there are only a couple things that I'm going to talk about. We're going to talk about DAG networks, we're going to talk about Active Manager, talk about best copy selection, and then everybody's favorite this week, we're going to talk about DAC mode and death as well. This is a deep dive, but we only have 75 minutes, and we can only go so far and so deep. So I strongly encourage you to supplement this with the concept session as well, because there's a lot of great stuff in there. So the first thing I want to talk about is database availability group networks. How many of you have actually already deployed a DAG? Awesome. Okay. How many of you think you know exactly what a DAG network is and how they work? Not as awesome. Okay, by the end of the session, you'll have it mastered. A DAG network is simply nothing more than a collection of subnets. Okay, one or more. Every DAG network has to have a subnet in it, or it's considered an empty DAG network, and it doesn't do anything. It's just an empty object. Okay, so that's what a DAG network is. In exchange, we have two types of DAG networks, and there's only two types. One is the MAPI network. Pretty self-explanatory name. That's the network that connects that server to other exchange servers, to DNS, to Active Directory, and ultimately through that path to your MAPI and other clients. That's also the network that has a very specific configuration. It's the only network that should be registered in DNS. It's the only network that should be using file and print sharing. The only network that should be using client for Microsoft networks. The only network that should have a default gateway assigned to it. By contrast, the other type of network we have is a replication network. And as its name implies, it's designed for use by continuous replication, the log shipping and the seeding, if you use it that way. By contrast with the MAPI network, a replication network does not have a default gateway configured. It is not registered in DNS. It does not use file and print sharing. It does not use client for Microsoft networks. Why are these things important? Because programmatically, we use these configuration elements when we're automatically creating these networks for you. These are the primary mechanisms we use to distinguish the administrator's intent based on network configuration, such that when you add a mailbox server to a DAG and the cluster enumerates this configuration and sends it up to us, we know what you want it to be for the MAPI network, and we know what you want it to be for the replication network, because this is how you've configured them. If you don't configure them properly, you won't get that predictable behavior, and you'll have some manual configuration steps that you'll need to do in order to get things working. So keep that in mind. It's very important that the configuration be just right. Now, our support boundary for networking has changed in Exchange 2010. It used to be with 2007 and earlier, for all highly available mailbox servers, we always required a minimum of two network cards. We don't anymore. We only require one network card. Whether you go to additional network cards largely depends on your needs. Do you have a lot of replication traffic? Do you have a large number of databases? Do you have a need to isolate your traffic? In a multi-data center environment, do you actually have separate redundant pathways between the data centers and so forth? But at a minimum, we now only require you to have one single network. Sure, a second one is preferred for redundancy, but we only require you to have one single network. In that case, that network is both the MAPI and replication network. So every DAG must have exactly one MAPI network. Now, every DAG can have zero or more replication networks. We don't require a replication network. That is an option that we give you. We do also support multiple replication networks. So if you do add multiple replication networks, we have a load balancing algorithm that we use between them. It's a least recently used algorithm. So when we ship stuff over the replication network, we keep track of which one we last used. And the least recently used one keeps going to the top of the list, and we load balance between them. Obviously, if one of those networks fail, we fail over to another network. If all replication networks fail, we fail over to the MAPI network. The MAPI network fails, we trigger a server failover. The server fails, we also trigger a server failover. So you can see this cascading failures that we correct and resolve for you. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the default DAG networks are created automatically the moment you add that server to the DAG, install the cluster service, join it to the cluster. Cluster enumerates the networks. You get one cluster network for every subnet on that box, and every cluster network must be on a separate subnet. And then cluster passes that information up into the Exchange Replication Service that then turns those into corresponding DAG networks. So just like there's a one-to-one mapping between the cluster subnets and the cluster networks, there's also a one-to-one mapping between the subnets and your DAG networks as well. And it's always going to be mapped that way. So here's a very simple example. I have a two-server DAG. Each server, EX1 and EX2, has two network cards in it. One on the 192.168.0 subnet, one on the 10.0.0 subnet. Okay, so it is multi-subnet, but both nodes have both networked on the same subnet. So, knowing that in this example, I have a total of two subnets, how many DAG networks do you think the system is going to create for me here? Just shout it out if you know it. Two, that's right, that's awesome. And that's exactly what you get. And these are the default names, DAG Network 01, DAG Network 02, DAG Network 03, and so forth. So looking at the configuration, you can see that it figured out that the 192.168.0, there were two NICs that are on that subnet that became part of DAG Network 1. The 10.0.0, there were two NICs that were on that subnet. They became part of DAG Network number 2. But the system also recognized the configuration differences between the two networks. And so, for instance, that's why for DAG Network 01, you can see that the MAPI access parameter is set to true. The system has correctly identified that as a MAPI network. And you can see that MAPI access is set to false on the other network because it's recognized that as a replication network. The other thing that's noteworthy is that all networks that are added, whether dynamically by the system or manually by an administrator, by default, they will all have replication enabled, including the MAPI network. So there's a checkbox there, and you can also use a commandlet to turn off replication on the MAPI network. And we'll talk about what that behavior is in a minute, so we'll come back to that. But let's make the problem a bit more interesting, or the configuration a bit more interesting. So same two servers, except now I've got four different subnets. I've got 192.168.0 for EX1, but 192.168.1 for EX2. Similarly, 10.0.0 for EX1 and 10.0.1 for EX2. So in this example, knowing now that instead of two, I now have four subnets, how many DAG networks do you think the system is going to create for me? Just shout it out if you know it. Four, that's right. Wow, you guys are awesome. But there's a problem here. In this configuration, unless you do what I'm about to tell you, even though you've got all these networks configured and two of which you've decided to use as a replication network, in this configuration, the system is only going to use the MAPI network for replication. Here's why. This is a very basic question. Do not overthink it. Just think of it in its most basic sense. What is the minimum that you need in order to have a network? I have this. What else do I need? Something else. Okay? One by itself. It's not a network. I need somewhere else to network with. If you look at these DAG networks, none of them have multiple subnets. None of them have multiple endpoints in them. We don't have a cohesive, logical network that we can use. But we have logic built into the system that says, if you're unable to figure out which replication network to use or to use a replication network at all, then even if the replication is disabled on the MAPI network, use DNS resolution. Okay, and of course, what is the only network that is registered in DNS? Shout it out if you know it. The MAPI network, that's right. So in this case, anytime the replication network is misconfigured, we fall back to DNS name resolution and we start using the MAPI network. So you have to do this process. We call it collapsing your DAG networks. And it's basically taking subnets from some of the DAG networks, putting them into other DAG networks, and then that creates empty ones, which you then delete. So there's actually four commands that you run, and they're very, very simple. And I've color-coded them because they word wrap. So it's white, yellow is the order that we're doing. So let's walk through these. So the first command, and they're both going to be using set DAG network. So the first command is going to take the subnets. In this case, I've decided to take the subnet from DAG network 03, move it up to DAG network 01. And in doing that, in order for me to assign subnets to a DAG, I can't just say, here's the new subnet I want to add in the shell. I have to actually include subnets that are already there. So you can see up at the top here, that's why I'm including the subnet that's already there for DAG Network 01 and the subnet I want to add. And then because I know DAG Network 01 is going to be my intended MAPI network, I'm also going to take this opportunity to set replication enabled to false as well. Turn off replication for normal operations on the MAPI network. So I do that, and now my configuration looks like this. I've moved the information from DAG Network 03 up to DAG Network 01, and DAG Network 03 is now empty, and DAG Network 01 now has the two subnets and interfaces I want. Then I run a similar command. Again, this time I'm manipulating DAG Network 02, adding both the subnets I want in there, and once I'm done with that, again, it takes the subnets from 4, moves it up into 2, and leaves 3 and 4 empty. Once you have an empty DAG network, simply use remove DAG network, and it'll go ahead and delete it for you. And when you're done with all four of those, you've got a nice tight configuration here, which is going to use all available networks, and it's going to adhere to best practices, and it's going to ensure that the replication network is used unless and until it has a problem. So when talking about networks, when you have a single NIC inside your box that's used both as the MAPI and replication network. And you can see the enable replication is going to be set to true in that case. When you have multiple networks, well, then you can start breaking out. One network becomes the mapping network, and then the other additional networks can be used for replication purposes. You can also modify some of the configuration in the GUI as well. So this is what the screen snapshot looks like. Here, I'm illustrating this because I pulled up the config for my mapping network, and this is that enable replication checkbox. That's the same thing as setting enable replication to false. On the mapping network, generally during normal operations, you want to uncheck that box. Okay, because remember, if you leave that box checked, yes, it's the mapping network, but that's the other flag that says, oh, it's also a replication network, which means that LRU algorithm that load balances between replication networks will use the mapping network for replication during normal operations. You probably don't want that to happen. You only want the mapping network to be used when there's no other networks available. So you uncheck this box, or you set enable replication to false. That means during normal operations, the LRU algorithm will not load balance that network. And that network will then only be used for replication if and only if all other replication networks fail. Now, we don't dynamically switch back, though. Once we've failed over to the mapping network for replication purposes, there's only two different ways to revert back to a replication network. So one way I don't recommend, which is actually cycling the replication service, because that's going to cause all sorts of side issues. That would do it, but we don't recommend it for obvious reasons. Other ways that you can do it would be to do a server switchover, or suspend and resume activation would actually be the most preferred way, because that has the least impact of anything. You could just very quickly suspend replication, and as soon as that resume comes in right away after that, we'll run the algorithm and start using the replication networks again. So although you can cycle the replication service, just do a suspend and resume, and that will take care of it for you. Now, there's other kind of networks you might have in there. You may be using iSCSI storage, so now you're going to have some iSCSI networks that the cluster will find and enumerate for you. Some customers also use dedicated backup networks as well, and as those are configured and the cluster sees them, the cluster is going to enumerate them and turn them into DAG networks as well. But anything that's not a MapU or a replication network should be completely ignored by the DAG and not used for any client access or any replication purpose. Okay, it should never be used. So we have a feature there that allows you to tell the DAG to simply ignore the network. And in fact, that's the command that you would use. You set DAG network, the identity, whatever's automatically created by the system for you, DAG network 01, 02, 03, etc. You set replication enabled to false, and you set ignore network to true. That disables and neuters that network completely from the DAG and the cluster's perspective. The cluster is still going to see it as a cluster network and heartbeat it, but if those heartbeats fail, it's not going to cause any problems for the DAG itself. Certainly, it may cause problems for the applications and services that are using that network, but it's not going to impact your DAG once you've isolated the network that way. Couple other things that you need to do. First, if you haven't already, you want to install this particular hotfix. This is especially important in a multi-subnet environment, because in a multi-subnet environment, remember, the replication network does not have a default gateway. So how does it get routed? Well, it gets routed by using static routes. So typically using NetSH, because we found route add to be unpredictable and unreliable. Unfortunately, or I should say ironically, NetSH had a bug as well, where persistent route entries would just fall off the route table and disappear. This bug fix fixes that. So you absolutely want this hot fix on all of your DAG members, because this is important to keep those routes up and persistent at all times. If they go down, again, everything's going to move over to the MapU network and start using that as well. The other configuration that we want you to do, and you've got a couple choices for doing this, you can use NetSH, you can use router ACLs, you can use, you know, lots of different methods to block this traffic. But whatever you do, there is some cross-traffic heartbeat stuff that you need to control. So here's a question for you. How many of you are familiar with the heartbeat network in a cluster? Okay, so shock of shocks, there is no such thing. There never has been. Ever, ever, ever. Why? Because in Windows failover clustering, all networks are heartbeated. There's no such thing as a heartbeat network, and there never has been. And in fact, if you read any of Microsoft documentation, we talk about networks that perform heartbeats, but we never talk about anything called a heartbeat network, again, because it's never existed. Okay, so this thing that you all just raised your hand up that you think you all know so well doesn't exist. And that's important. You have to understand that all networks are heartbeated because it has significant implications when you take a DAG that has multiple network cards in it and you extend it out to 16 members across multiple subnets. Because all of these network interfaces on every DAG member now has the ability to heartbeat every other interface on every other DAG member. So looking in this solution, these four boxes are intended to be DAG networks that have both MAPI and replication networks on different subnets. What you want to do is you want to block traffic such that the MAPI network on one server can only heartbeat the MAPI networks on the other servers. It cannot heartbeat any replication networks. Similarly, you don't want the replication network to be able to heartbeat any MAPI networks on any other servers. You only want it to be able to heartbeat the replication interfaces that are used as part of the same DAG network. You don't even want it to heartbeat another replication network. Why? Because you will have significant heartbeat crosstalk traffic that could saturate your links. So you need to block this stuff. Another reason we want you to block it is because it diminishes the system's ability to distinguish between a server failure and a network failure. And in some configurations, that may not be a big deal, particularly those configurations that only have a single network card in them, because if that fails, that does trigger a server failover. We would consider that a failed server. But if you've gone and taken the time to architect a solution that has multiple replication cards in it, you don't want the system to mistakenly infer that the loss of one of those network cards could also mean the loss of the server, when in fact there may be another pathway there. So you need to block this heartbeat crosstalk. And as I said, you've got a couple different ways that you can do it. Router ACLs are common in large enterprises. NetSH is common in smaller enterprises. But any way that you have a mechanism for blocking this traffic, employ it and utilize it. Okay, let's talk about Active Manager now. So Active Manager, we're going to go pretty deep into what it actually does. We're going to go really under the hood. And as I said, some of this stuff is good to know, but it's not a lot of hands-on stuff where you're going to go back and start looking at Active Manager. Because really, there's not a whole lot to look at. It's an internal component. There's no Active Manager service. It's code and functionality that runs inside the Microsoft Exchange replication service on every single mailbox server, including standalone mailbox servers. And in fact, it's for that reason that the replication service is a required service on all mailbox servers, even standalone mailbox servers. It's required to be up and running. Because even though the information store still does the actual mount and attaching to the database, in 2010, it will and can only do that if Active Manager asks it to. And if AM is not running, nothing mounts. So that service always has to be running, even on standalone servers. Now, historically, when you wanted to find out where a user's mailbox was located or where a particular database was mounted, you looked in Active Directory. Maybe some of you are application developers that are used to querying Active Directory for the location of a database. Well, we actually don't store that information in AD anymore. In the model that we have in Exchange 2010 with the DAG, where a single database can move between DAG members within 30 seconds or less, we just can't store it in AD. It won't work. We'd be completely bound by AD replication latency, and we wouldn't be able to get that information around, certainly within 30 seconds, maybe not even within 30 minutes. But as it turns out, if you write stuff into the cluster database, well, that's instantly replicated to all the other clusters, all the other members of that cluster. So that's near real-time instantaneous replication of that information. So as a result, that's where Active Manager now stores that information, making Active Manager now the definitive and sole source for the information as to where a database is located and mounted. And there's also Active Manager client components. There's one running in the RPC client access service on CAS. There's one running in the transport stack on Hub. And those client components query the Active Manager in the DAG to get that information, to find out where the user's mailbox is located so they can hook them up through CAS, to find out where they're located so that they can deliver messages into their mailbox and so forth. So that's some of the basics. There's several Active Manager roles. Until I add the mailbox server to a DAG, it's always going to be running in the standalone Active Manager role. For our discussion, that's not very interesting because we're talking about highly available mailbox servers, not standalone servers. But be aware, Active Manager is operational and required for standalone servers as well. Once you add the server to the DAG, it inherits one of two roles, either the primary Active Manager, Pam, or the standby Active Manager, Sam. And I will resist temptation to make a green eggs and ham joke right now. And as I said, the Active Manager client running on the RPC client access service and inside the transport stack. So that are literally all of the Active Manager components in Exchange and where they live. So let's talk about what they do. The primary Active Manager, that's sort of the gatekeeper, the linchpin, the one and only Active Manager role that can actually take corrective action. All Active Manager roles do monitoring, but only the PAM can take corrective action. The SAM is not allowed to do anything that involves corrective action on its own, with one teeny tiny little exception that I'll tell you about in a few minutes. But otherwise, it's the PAM that controls everything. If the topology of the DAG changes, it's the PAM that gets those updates and propagates them out by writing them in the cluster database. It also is responsible for reacting to server failures. So even if the databases or one of the servers hosting the SAM role fails, it's up to the PAM to take corrective action. So if SAM detects that anything went wrong, SAM has to tell PAM, and PAM will fix it, if it can. And of course, one of PAM's most important jobs, which we're going to go into in depth in a bit, is the best copy selection process, the process of actually picking one of the passive copies to activate as the new active copy in response to some failure. Now, all active managers, as I said, they all do monitoring, but their monitoring is isolated to their local information store and their databases. All DAG members maintain an in-memory and in-file through the cluster database a listing or a cache, if you will. I don't want to call it a database cache because that's not what it is. It's separate. It's just a cache of the list of databases that it has. So it's different from the database cache that, for instance, Jeff was talking about earlier. So that's what the PAM role does. The SAM, that's on every other node of the DAG. So in every DAG, there's always and only going to be one node that has the PAM role. And it's always going to be whichever node owns the default core cluster group resources. So as that server goes down or as those resources move around, the PAM role moves around with it. And if another server is the SAM, SAM will become the PAM, and the original PAM will become the SAM. It's that simple. So the SAM is on every other node that is not the primary Active Manager. It's sitting there monitoring its local information store, its local databases for failures. It's sitting there responding to CAS and HUV for those queries as to where a user's database is located. And if there are any failures, it's reporting those to PAM so that PAM can go ahead and take the corrective action. Both roles are necessary for automatic recovery. The basic rule is if you don't have the replication service running, you don't have an operating mailbox server, whether it's a standalone mailbox server or a DAG member. If the replication service is not running, databases are dismounted on all mailbox servers. Now, it's important to understand which one is the PAM, because in addition to providing the corrective action, the PAM role also provides the administrative interface as well. So anytime you're using the Exchange Management Console or the Exchange Management Shell, and you're using any of the database availability group commands or wizards, you are interfacing directly with the PAM. And you are doing so via RPC communication. Now, in a large network where you might have DAG members located in another site, that could have some implications for you. If you're on your workstation doing your thing with your DAG commandlets, you do some commandlets. It's going to RPC to any DAG member that it can talk to in that DAG. If that happens to be the PAM, great, it'll continue doing what it's doing. If it's the SAM's going to refer you again via RPC to wherever the PAM is. So if you're going over the WAN, that could have some implications for you because it could make you susceptible to RPC latency and slow down some of the tasks that you're trying to accomplish. Now, you can always find out where the PAM role is by doing the get DAG, and in this case, we're just looking for the primary Active Manager property coming back. That will give you the name of the server that currently owns that role. If you want to or need to, you can then move that role by simply using one of the two commands to move the cluster group. If you're on Windows 2008 R2, use the PowerShell commandlet. If you're not on R2, we don't support PowerShell, you have to use the old style cluster group move command. That's how you move the PAM role, and that's how you determine where the PAM is. And the transition of the state from standalone to PAM, from PAM to SAM and back and forth, all of this is logged inside the Crimson channel. So once I had this server, here's E14EX1. You can see it says it's been running as a standalone for 3 days. This is a server that is a mailbox server that I have not added to a DAG yet. Once I add it to a DAG, now Active Manager detects these configuration changes. In this case, it detected that it changed from a standalone to PAM. Why PAM? Because this was the first server I added to the DAG. When you've only got one DAG member, it is the PAM. It's got the cluster group, so it's always going to be the PAM. So you can see there's a lot of logging that we go in through here. We can see a change from standalone to PAM, and then it'll do the configure update periodically to tell you how long it's been running in that role. Similarly, here's E14EX2, my second server. I'm now adding this to the DAG, and it's detected that it wants to change from standalone to SAM. Why SAM? Because EX14.1 was put there first, and it's the PAM role. So because we already have a PAM, any further servers that I add automatically inherit the SAM role. So you can see that transition here. Configuration change detected. We're running a SAM. We've been running. Here's a situation where I did a failover. Now we're changing from SAM to PAM. It's fun to say these names. And so you kind of get the idea here. PAM to SAM, SAM to PAM, we go back and forth. Life is good. So other than that kind of stuff, Active Manager has a lot of responsibilities, a lot of functionality. It is the linchpin of our high availability platform. We're not a cluster-aware application anymore, or spin it the other way, the cluster has no idea we're there. We don't use the cluster resource model anymore. So because the cluster has no idea we're there, we had to have some other mechanism that would detect failures and fail over for us. That's what Active Manager is there for. That's its purpose in life. That's what it was created to do. Replace the cluster resource model that monitored and provided failover for Exchange resources. So of course it mounts and dismounts databases. The store, as I said earlier, does the actual mounting and attaching to the database, but only if Active Manager tells it to. It also provides database health and status information. So if I run test replication health, or if I run get mailbox database copy status, or some of the other monitoring stuff that we have, I'm getting that information from Active Manager. It also, as I mentioned earlier, it's your interface for admin tasks. Anything that you do through the shell, through the console, is all interfacing with Active Manager, in particular the PAM role. It also maintains the server and state information, so as you're looking in the GUI, things like copy queue length, replay queue length, content index state, and so forth, copy status, and so forth, all of that stuff is also tracked and logged by Active Manager. And of course, it monitors for failures and initiates recovery, which arguably is its most important function. So let's talk about some of this functionality at an operational level. So we have these operations called database star over. So star over is a shorthand notation for switchovers and failovers. So a failover, hopefully all of you know what that is. It's a cluster term that we've been using for many years now. That's where the system automatically initiates corrective action. By contrast, a switchover is a manual operation that the administrator performs when they want to move a database to some other server. Okay, that's the two differences. Together, we call those star overs. All star over operations, except for the ones that result in hard termination or hard failure of the server, they're going to begin with a dismount of the active copy, and they're going to end always, hopefully successfully, with the mount of the passive copy as it's turned into the active copy. So that's part of the process there. So mounting and dismounting databases, yes, I'm sure we've all done that a million times, but there are implications that are now controlled by Active Manager in terms of where they'll mount and where they'll dismount. So the mounting of the database, that's going to be obviously the last part of a database star over. That's the last thing we do is we mount the database and then the operation's done. Dismounting, that's the first part of something like a database switchover. We have to dismount that database, bring it into a known state before we can activate some passive copy of it. Switchovers are almost always lossless. The only time they're going to be lossy is if you're forcing a switchover intentionally with known data loss. In other words, you're forcibly mounting a database that you know does not have all of the required logs. So that could be a forcible dismount or forcible mount that resulted in data loss. Assuming you don't have a problem with the logs and your logs are all available, all of your switchovers should be lossless. Now, I mentioned earlier that the SAM was not able to do any corrective action on its own. There's one exception to that, and the exception is any time a DAG member loses quorum. Anytime that happens, the SAM has immediate instructions to forcibly terminate the store process and immediately dismount all databases. That's a safety mechanism built into Exchange that we allow the SAM to do that one thing on its own without having to talk to the PAM first. And that's for obvious reasons. If it's something where it's a lost quorum situation, it's losing quorum largely in part because it can't talk to other DAG members or can't talk to the PAM. So in that case, that is the one situation. This auto dismount is the one place in which the SAM can actually take a corrective action by self-protecting itself after a loss of quorum. Everything else is up to the PAM. This is the only exception to the SAM can do corrective action rule. Okay. Now, you saw earlier some of those high availability transition event log entries. We actually do quite a bit of rigorous logging inside the Crimson channel in the Windows event log. How many of you are familiar with the Crimson channel? Okay. Remind me again, how many of you are responsible for administering DAGs day to day? No, seriously, I'm not making fun. Okay. Because you really, really want to get to know the Crimson channel. Now, that may have been somewhat of a misleading question, because for all I know, you've actually seen this stuff and you just didn't know it was called the Crimson channel. So let me go forward a little bit and show you what it looks like. There's a couple areas. One is a pre-built event that we have. But if you look down here, under this Applications and Services Logs, Microsoft Exchange, High Availability, Mailbox Database Failure Events, and Troubleshooters, that is the Crimson channel. It's a feature inside of Windows 2008 that allows application developers and applications to leverage an eventing infrastructure such that they can report things that are interesting for the application, interesting for the developers of the application, and consumable by the application as well. So in our case, we leverage the Crimson channel both ways. Not only do we plumb it with information, but we monitor it for information as well. So perfect example is if you have any underlying storage problems and you encounter some form of ESE error with your database, some sort of JET error. When that happens, that event gets logged in the Crimson channel. Active Manager subscribes to the Crimson channel. When that event occurs, that's how Active Manager finds out about it. And that's how Active Manager can initiate the corrective action. Of course, there's other mechanisms in case we can't, for whatever reason, log to that. We've got other recovery behaviors, some of which you may have read about. For instance, there's a phenomenon where if we have hung I/O and we're not able to write anything to the event log, we will actually have Active Manager terminate WinInet in a forcible and intended bug check of the box. Hey, yes, you heard me right. Exchange will intentionally blue screen a Windows server if it detects a hung I/O condition and we can't write into the event log as a result of this. That is not unique to Exchange. Exchange is simply exploiting behavior that Windows provides for us. And Exchange is not the first application to do that. Windows will bug check itself if it feels that the system or some data is in jeopardy under certain cases as well. In the case of hung I/O, there's not a whole lot you can do to recover from that automatically. Your best bet is to go ahead and bug check the box, allow everything to gracefully fail over to other services, and when that box comes up, maybe the problem will be fixed, maybe it won't be, but at least now you've got something that you can work on. So in terms of the Crimson channel, you can see a lot of the different things that we include in there. Many of these events are not going to be for you. Many of these events are extremely cryptic, and they're really just for the developers because you need the symbols and the source code in order to interpret them. So you're going to see stuff in there that's going to be somewhat meaningless for you, but you'll also see a very rich set of information, such as that Active Manager transition stuff, such as things related to databases and single copy status, and other information about the health and state of your databases as well. So largely, the troubleshooter and the debug event logs are not going to be for you at all. I mean, you can go in there, but you're not going to understand a single event that's in there because they are for the developer only. But if you go into the operational event logs, that's where a lot of the good stuff is. That's where you can really get a deep understanding of what Active Manager is doing and what your DAG members are doing with this reporting channel. Okay. So now let's talk about perhaps the most important thing that Active Manager does, and that's this process that we call best copy selection. So what is this? Well, best copy selection, and usually when we say it, I say best in air quotes, because best is subjective, best is relative to the nature of the failure, best is relative to the conditions surrounding the activation, best is subjective with respect to some of the server settings that you may have configured and so forth. So when we say best copy selection, that's not Active Manager definitively saying that, yes, this copy that I'm activating now is absolutely your best copy. There's no guarantee on that. And there's no guarantee that the copy that you want to be tried to be activated first is going to happen either. We do our best to do that, but it's impossible to cover every possible failure scenario and cover every possible recovery scenario. So when a failure affects an active copy, or if an administrator does what we call a targetless switchover, that's when BCS kicks in. So if you don't know what targetless switchover is, my saying, I want to move this database over to another DAG member, but I'm not going to tell the system what DAG member. I'm just going to leave it targetless and let Active Manager choose which one it thinks it should go over to. That's a targetless switchover. You don't always have to say where you want to switch over to. You have the ability to let Exchange choose for you. And when you do, that's the best copy selection process. Now, you also have this option of blocking servers and databases from activation. Common scenario is you've got a remote data center and you want those databases to be for DR only and not for HA, so you would block them from automatic activation. A DR type of database would be only manually activated by an administrator if it needed to be. An HA database is the one that gets automatically activated by the system. Similarly, if you were deploying a lagged database copy, you would also block that from activation as well. You don't want the system to ever automatically activate a lagged copy as well. Now, the best copy selection process is largely the same in RTM as it is in SP1 and later, except the first step is different depending on one of your settings. So let's talk about what the steps are in RTM, because as I said, they're very, very similar, and then I'll tell you the difference in SP1. So when we have a failure affecting the database, the first thing that Active Manager does is it looks at the available passive copies, and it sorts them in a list based on their copy queue length. So the lower the copy queue length, the more current and up-to-date that database is, so it goes to the top of the list. If it turns out that multiple passive copies have the same copy queue length, we break that tie using a second property called activation preference. That's just a number assigned to the database, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And the lower the activation preference number, the higher it goes in the list. So if I have two databases with a copy queue length of 10, this one has an activation preference of 2, this one has one of 3, the one that has 2 goes higher in the list. And we use this sorted list so that we can sort through it and find which of the databases in our list meet this specific criteria. And there's actually 10 sets of criteria that we have that I'll show you in a minute. Then once we figured out which ones meet the criteria, we start at the top of the remaining list and we try to activate them one by one until we get one that activates. And I'll illustrate this in a moment for you. I know that can be difficult to follow along. So we sort the criteria and we try to activate one. We say, this is the one we want to try. And so then a process runs called ACL, attempt copy last logs. And we try to go back to the original source, the original active copy, and get any missing log files. So if the database I'm trying to activate had a copy queue length of 10, there are 10 missing log files that I need to bring this database completely up to date. So the ACL process then goes and tries to get those 10 missing log files and move it over to the passive copy being activated. That's my ride, ignore that. I told you, leave the Humvee outside. Now, where the steps differ is in SP1. The first step can be different if your auto database mount dial setting is set to a value of lossless. How many of you know what the auto database mount dial setting does? Oh boy, okay. How many of you are running CCR in Exchange 2007? All right, and how many of you are running DAGs again? All right, you want to know this property. Usually this is something that ends up getting covered in the concept session. But if you haven't seen that, or judging by the show of hands, it looks like maybe you don't know what it is. We actually introduced this property in 2007, so it's not new in 2010. There is a default setting in this property, so if you don't know what it is, it's doing things behind the scenes for you right now that you may or may not want. So if you go back to the Exchange 2003 days, if you were missing, say for instance, the last log or the last couple logs in that log stream, we would not mount that database. We had those required logs. Every log that was generated met the checkpoint file, and that meant it was going to be required in order to mount that database. That changed in 2007. In 2007, as databases became much larger and as they continue to grow, we started with an understanding that administrators would prefer to have a trade-off. And the trade-off is they would much prefer to have a database that is mostly up to date, that is online and able to service users, than to have a database that's missing one or two logs that's down that now either has to be restored or repaired. So we let them make that trade-off. We let them make that trade-off through what we call the auto database mount dial setting. It's a property setting on every Exchange 2010 mailbox server. And the auto database mount dial is the setting that tells Active Manager how many log files you will tolerate being missing from the database while still allowing the database to be mounted. So we have several values for that that you can set this dial to. One is lossless. A lossless setting on auto database mount dial means you will tolerate zero missing log files. That's your way of telling Active Manager if that copy queue length is not zero, if you don't have all the log files, do not mount that database. I only want lossless recovery. Okay? And typically in lossless, that's going to require an administrator to intervene, recover, or get any of the missing log files in order to manually mount. Other settings are good availability and best availability. Good availability is 6 or fewer missing log files. Best availability is 12 or fewer missing log files. So we say good availability or best availability because we're referring to the availability of the database itself, not the availability of the missing data. That's why with best availability, you have a higher data loss. You've got 12 logs that can be lost. Now, it's okay to lose logs because we thought of that too. Okay, and inside every hub transport server that you have in your organization is a little queue called the transport dumpster. And any messages that are sent to any mailbox that is sitting on a mailbox database that is replicated into DAG, a copy of those stays in the transport dumpster. And we get feedback from the replication pipeline so that at any given time, largely what's in your transport dumpster is data that has not been replicated yet. So what happens if you lost that data because you had a lossy failover? When the new active copy comes up, it's going to go ahead and request redelivery of that data from the transport dumpster, and that's how you get those messages back. Now, there's some data that gets lost that's unrecoverable. Things like stuff maybe users had in their drafts folder or somebody accepting an appointment, those kinds of things. Generally, the data that gets lost is data that is very easily recreatable through user action. The user could fix it up themselves. It's not a big deal. We're not talking about missing messages. We get those back through transport dumpster. So that's where you can increase the log tolerance. Now, in SP1, we made a change. And the change is the first step of BCS. And that step is if an administrator has explicitly set the auto database mount dial to a setting of lossless on all the mailbox servers that host a copy of the database, then instead of sorting the initial list by copy queue length, because that's going to be irrelevant because we're only looking for zero copy queue lengths, so we don't care what they are because they have to be lossless, we now instead sort by the activation preference number completely, and we don't use the copy queue length at all in that case. So that is the only difference. If you don't have the dial set to lossless, which if you don't know what it was, there's no way you would have set it to lossless, so then you're still at the default, which is good availability or 6 logs lost, 6 or fewer. Now, don't be confused. Good availability was also the default in 2007 CCR, but the values were different. In CCR, good availability was 3 or fewer logs, and best availability were 6 or fewer logs. In 2010, we doubled that. So good is still the default, but it's now 6, and best is now 12. And there's also another setting that, just as a side note, I'll mention. There is also a setting of mount dial override. In other words, when you're doing one of those forcible switchovers that I talked about earlier, that where you know you've got data loss and you're forcing it, one of the auto database mount dial settings you can then impose is called best effort. And best effort is boundless. It says it doesn't matter how many log files this database is missing. It could be 20, it could be 20,000. It doesn't care. Your best effort is your way of saying, just mount whatever you have. I really need this. This is my last resort. And it really is a last resort kind of thing. Best effort is it could be a very dangerous thing for people to use, which is why it's not one of the default settings. You can only have lossless, good availability, or best availability as the normal settings. Now, the fourth step is the same. So we've talked about the difference between RTM and SP1 with respect to the first three steps, remembering that the only difference is really in that first step when you have auto database mount dial set to lossless. The fourth step is always going to be the same. So the ACL process is finished. It tried to copy any missing log files from the active copy over to the passive copy it's trying to activate. Maybe that was successful, maybe not, we don't know, but when ACL finishes, it tells Active Manager that it's done. Active Manager then now has a question to answer, and the answer is simply, is the database mountable? And the answer to that is determined by looking at the number of missing log files and seeing if it's within the auto database mount dial threshold. So even if the ACL process wasn't able to get any log files, it still might be able to mount that database because the number of missing log files is within your threshold. Okay, so that's how that works. Now, if the answer to that question is yes, Active Manager marks that as the new active and tells the information store to mount it. If the answer to that question, though, is no, in other words, the number of missing log files is outside that dial range, then the database is not mounted, and Active Manager will try to activate the next one in the list if there's one available. So, what does that list look like? Well, this is the selection criteria that we use. After we have our sorted list, we walk down that list looking for databases that meet this criteria, starting with criteria 1. Ideally, we want to find a database that has a copy queue length less than 10, a replay queue length less than 50, and a content index status of healthy. If we can't find anything on our sorted list that meets that, we degrade the criteria slightly. You can see, instead of a healthy content index, we'll accept one that's crawling, one that's still indexing. Okay, the client experience for online search might be impacted, but you've got a healthy database and we can get it online. After that, you can see the criteria degrades. We stop looking at copy queue length for a while and focus on replay queue length. Then we stop looking at replay queue length and focus back on copy queue length. Finally, we get down to number 10 and we say, well, does any of the databases on this sorted list meet the 10th criteria? Hopefully we found one by then, but if none of the databases on that sorted list meet any of these criteria, then it will be up to you as the administrator to take manual intervention. Okay? Typically in those cases, your DAG and your databases are in a very, very bad state to begin with, and you would have needed to take intervention anyway. So how does it work? Let me break it all down for you and make it super simple. I've got a 4-node DAG. Okay, it's got active copy on server 1, passive copies on 2, 3, and 4. You can see what the activation preference is. You can see their copy queue lengths. You can see their replay queue lengths, the content index state, and the database state. So we have a failure affecting the active copy. Now best copy selection process kicks in. The first thing it does is it looks at these available copies, and it sorts them by their copy queue length. Okay, so ideally, So we sort them by their copy queue length, so you can see the sorted list. Server 3 has the lowest copy queue length, so it comes up first. Server 2 has the next lowest copy queue length, so it's next. And then server 4 has the highest copy queue length, so it's last in the list. Now, of these two servers, and we don't need to use activation preference as a tiebreaker because none of the copy queue lengths are the same, but you can see what that would have been like had we used it. Now, out of these three database copies that Active Manager has to choose from, only two of the three of them meet that first set of criteria. Only two of the three databases have a copy queue length less than 10, and a replay queue length less than 50, and a content index state of healthy. And because server 3 happens to have the lowest copy queue length, it's at the top of the list, it gets tried first. But it's not a guarantee that the database on server 3 is going to be activated. Because going back to the scenario where you might have had the dial set low, let's pretend that server 3's copy queue length was 7 instead of 4. Once the ACL process does its thing, maybe it wasn't able to get any log files at all. Which means even though that's the best one as it appears now, once the ACL process was done, the copy queue length meant it was over the auto database mount dial threshold, and so instead of trying to activate server number 3, it's going to activate the next one in the list instead. It could literally be caused by something as simple as somebody rebooting server 3 accidentally. You know, they pull the power cord or they powered off the wrong server. So server 3 is down. So when the other excuse me, not server 3, server 1, where the active database was located. So when the other servers try to go back to server 1 to get missing log files, perhaps when server 3 is tried, the original server, server 1, is still down and you can't copy anything from there. So Active Manager goes on to the next one. Maybe by that time, server 1's been rebooted. The ACL process can get every missing log file, and you might even have a lossless failover happening on server 2 instead of server 3. Just again, because of the nature of the failure, your setting of the auto database mount dial, its ability as to whether or not it can copy those log files and so forth. So it can be very complicated. Now, in SP1, the only difference here is I've set all my servers to lossless now. Same scenario though, all the other metrics, the copy queue length, the preference, everything is identically the same. The only thing is I changed that dial setting to lossless from the default of good availability. Same scenario, I lose the active copy on server 1. Now we've got to get our sorted list going. But in this case, Active Manager knows I've sorted by a lossless auto database mount dial, so it's not going to give me a sorted list by copy queue length. Remember, lossless is saying it doesn't matter what the current copy queue length, because whatever it is, it's got to be 0 when you try to mount that. So we don't need to sort by copy queue length anymore, and instead, we give the activation preference number a little bit more meaning. In other words, now we're using it more the way the administrator expects it to be used. And if an administrator says, this has an activation preference of 2, and this has an activation preference of 3, that's the admin way of saying, I prefer this one first. In a perfect world, activate this one first. If you can't, try 3. If that doesn't work, try 4, et cetera, et cetera. So the scenario is the same, except now we're sorting, because we're set to lossless, on the activation preference number. And since the activation preference number conveniently matches the server number in my example, then server 2 has the lowest preference value, so it's tried first. Again, it's tried first. This doesn't mean, and it's not a guarantee, that that's the database that's going to be active, but this is now the order in which we would try if you were set this way. Now, after activation has occurred, the database that was passive has now become active. We'll say it became mountable. It's now the new active database. What it's going to do is it's going to initiate those transport dumpster redelivery requests. And because we have the ability for a database to move between AD sites, it's actually going to ask for redelivery from transport dumpsters both in the old site and the new site as well. So we've got full coverage of wherever that data might be. Then the new active one is mounted. It's generating log files, continuing with the log sequence where it left off, which means now there's some divergence on the original active copy. There may be some log files that had the same log sequence number on the active copy that need to be reconciled. And we do that through a mechanism called incremental resync. Incremental resync matches up the database and walks up the log files and finds where that divergence exists. And if it can, it will throw away the data that's not good and bring over the data and resynchronize those copies. Now, of course, that's only going to work for you if the original active copy was viable. So in the case where somebody powered off the server or pulled the plug, it's probably going to be viable. But if the nature of the failure was such that the underlying storage went away and it took the database with it, well, then there's nothing for incremental resync to do. And in that case, you'd be looking at a reseed operation if that formerly active, now passive copy is not viable for you. So one of two things will happen after that. Incremental resync will either bring it up to date and synchronize it and make it a healthy passive copy, or if that's not possible, you'll have to reseed that and create a new healthy passive copy for yourself. Okay. The last thing I want to talk about is Data Center Activation Coordination Mode, DAC mode, also known as the Mommy May I Mount bit. That is its actual name. If you look in the code, that's its name. And in fact, since I know you all are trivia lovers, Data Center Activation Coordination Mode, I made that name up. Why? Because I can't document something called the Mommy May I Mount bit. First of all, it's not a technical term, although it's appropriate for what we're doing in this context. But second of all, it doesn't localize very well either. So imagine that in French or Chinese or Spanish. Plus, doesn't it sound a lot cooler if it's Data Center Activation Coordination Mode, DAC mode? Serious stuff. But it really is the Mommy May I Mount bit. And it's a very, very simple concept to understand. I am mystified by some of the usage I've seen and heard of DAC mode, some of the things people have said about it, some of the things people have written about it. I'm perplexed as to why what I believe to be a very, very simple concept is not sticking with people after many years of talking about this. So let me try to break it down in its simplest terms so that when you leave, you can go correct everybody else out there as to what DAC mode is. Okay? DAC mode is literally just a property. It's one property value that you set on a DAG. Okay? You run set DAG, you set data center activation mode to DAG only. Okay? Why DAG only? That's your way of telling Active Manager that this is an Active Manager instance that's running in a DAG. It's not a standalone server. So you put that DAG in DAC mode by setting this property. What does that do for you? It does two things for you. One, it allows you during a data center switchover to use our built-in commandlets instead of having to use the cluster commands. Whoop-de-doo. Okay? The cluster demands will still do the same thing for you. They're not going to do anything different that our commands will do for you. The only difference is we think it's cooler to use our stuff because it's native and built into Exchange. But largely, hey, everyone, I didn't know there were so many people here. But largely, that's not the most important side effect. The most important thing it does is when you have a data center switchover scenario where you have activated your standby data center, and now you're in the process of restoring service to your primary data center, and you bring up that primary data center because it's got power and everything's running, but you don't have WAN connectivity. Now, remember, the primary data center is where the majority of your votes for your DAG should be. So when the primary data center fails, that's why you have to manually activate the secondary data center, because the majority has gone away. The secondary data center has lost quorum, and the data center switchover shrinks it, regains quorum, and brings those survivors up and running. But that's only half the process. Now you want to restore service to the primary. So you bring up the primary, but you bring it up without WAN connectivity. The primary, because it has the majority of voters, will have quorum. And in the absence of DAC mode, any DAG member that has quorum is allowed to mount all of the databases for which it believes to be active. With DAC mode, Active Manager has to ask permission from other DAG members or be able to talk to all other DAG members before it will be able to mount its databases. Let me walk you through that. So it's kind of an application level form of quorum. That's its intent. The intent was not to make our commandlet experience better. We just prefer that you use our commandlets in DAC mode, although there's not even a requirement to do that. The cluster commands will work fine in DAC mode as well. But DAC mode is really there to prevent that split brain scenario in that one scenario and only that one scenario. It was not designed for anything else. And it uses another fancy name I made up called the Data Center Activation Coordination Protocol. You gotta call it a protocol to make it sound cool. And it's really nothing more than a bit in memory. It's a zero or a one. Zero says, no, I don't have permission to mount databases. One says, yeah, I've got permission to mount databases. That's what that does. Now, it's an in-memory bit, and it's held in Active Manager, which means it's in the replication service. If you stop and restart the replication service, it's going to reset that bit back to zero, and it will have to try to set it back to one based on the criteria that I'll give you. Now, just because the DACP bit is set to one doesn't mean it will mount. It means it can if something called auto-mount consensus is true. The auto-mount is the process that Active Manager goes through to basically cross the T's and dot the I's and verify that the databases are where they should be located. We know which ones are active and which ones are passive and which ones can be mounted by which servers. So even though the DACP bit may get set to one, if we don't reach auto-mount consensus, the database won't mount, but that will be for other reasons, not because of the DACP bit. So, how does it work? Well, every time the replication service starts, Active Manager initializes. And initially, its DACP bit in memory is set to zero. Now it tries to communicate with the other DAG members. During normal operations of a DAG, every DAG member that is up and running appears on a DAG property called the Started Mailbox Servers list. Any DAG members that are not operational or have been marked as stopped by one of our commandlets, they appear on the Stopped Mailbox Servers list. So at any given time during normal operations, all of your DAG members should be listed on the Started Mailbox Servers list for that DAG. So when a starting DAG member comes up, that's the first thing it tries to do. Communicate with all of the members on that Started Mailbox Servers list. If it can do that, then it has permission to flip its bit to 1 and try to start mounting its databases. If it can't, then it must at least be in communication with another DAG member that also has its bit to 1. And if it can talk to any other DAG member that has a bit set to 1, that then also gives it permission, and it can mount databases. But if it cannot talk to all of the servers on the started mailbox service list, or at least just one other DAG member that has the bit set to 1, then its bit will stay at 0, and it will not mount databases. It's very, very simple. Here's how we have it. Here's why it's around. I've got my DAG extended into 2 data centers. And this is just showing the DAG. We're not showing CAS or Hub or anything, because DAC is only for the DAG. I've got my DAG extended into 2 data centers. I've got my primary on the left, secondary on the right. And in my primary, of course, is my witness server. That's why it's my primary. And I have a catastrophe. I lose my primary data center. Maybe the power goes out and it takes the WAN with it. Now, the administrators, working with the other executive stakeholders in the company, they decide it's going to be down for a while. We have to do a data center switchover. So they do the data center switchover. Or actually, let me back up a second. No, I just gave that away. OK, what happens when the primary goes away? You just saw it. You lose quorum in the other side, too. So hence, they decide to make the decision to do the data center switchover. So they do that. They use the commandlets because they're in DAC mode, and they shrink the DAG, they shrink the underlying cluster, they regain quorum, they specify an alternate witness server, and life is good. You're back up and running with service in your backup data center just like you'd want from the solution, just like you planned for. Now, primary data center comes up online. It's got power and everything, but WAN connectivity is still down. And so now you can sort of see where the problem comes in. Over here on the primary side, they still have a majority. A 4-member DAG has a total of 5 votes, and it needs 3 out of 5 to maintain quorum. Once these 3 come up, they've got quorum. They have their 3 out of 5. But their startup sequence isn't going to allow them to contact either all the mailbox servers on the started mailbox server, which from their perspective will be all the DAG members, because they don't know that a data center switchover occurred. They don't know that the stop mailbox server list is now populated with themselves, because they were all offline when all this has happened, and they're still offline as far as Active Directory replication is concerned. So they leave their bits set at 0. They don't have WAN connectivity, and they won't mount. So as a result, you can't get into a split brain condition because we prevent that from happening by requiring them to have permission. Okay, one of the side effects of enabling DAC mode. One of the side effects, remember, the rules of DAC, I got to talk to either a DAG member that has a bit set to 1 or all DAG members on the started mailbox service list. So let's say I need to take an entire DAG down for maintenance now. So I go 1 by 1 by 1 by 1, gracefully powering down, gracefully moving databases until I get to the last one, and then we do the shutdown. We do whatever it is we needed to do, and we start bringing them up. When I bring up the first one, obviously it's not going to have quorum. It's not going to do anything. Bring up the second one. Still might not have quorum, still might not be doing anything. Bring up more, even until I get to the last one, until I bring up that very last one, none of the databases are going to mount. Because when you shut down a DAG, you're basically saying that all your bits are going back to 0. So now the rule is you're not going to be able to talk to anybody else that has a bit set to 1 because we shut you all down and reverted your bits to 0. So now you have to be able to talk to every single server that's on the started mailbox servers list, and you won't be able to do that until those servers are actually started. And so when you're in DAC mode and you shut down a whole DAG, none of your databases are going to mount until you bring up the whole DAG. That's an important side effect to be aware of. Now, the other thing to be aware of is there are certain implications that you have when you've done a data center switchover and you end up with a single surviving node inside your standby data center. So you're down to 1 DAG member in the standby data center. Now, in that case, even though it's an odd number of members in the DAG, we actually will make you use the alternate witness server in that case. And in fact, we use that because we need some secondary thing to verify whether or not we should mount databases based on reboot conditions. So we actually use WMI to look at the boot time of both the single surviving DAG member and the witness server. And we do that because we want to look for a condition where the boot times don't match what we have recorded. If the boot times don't match what we recorded in the registry or in the cluster database, that is the indication to the system that these boxes have been rebooted since the switchover took place. And what that means that you don't ever want to reboot that single server and that single surviving witness server at the same time, okay? Because that's going to cause problems for you where you'll need to manually force the mount after that. You won't auto-mount in that case. It's okay to reboot one, it's okay to reboot the other independently, but if you end up rebooting them both, auto-mount consensus won't reach true. It'll stay at false, and it'll be up to the administrator to manually forcibly mount those databases. So just be aware of those couple side effects when you're using DAC mode. But otherwise, that's all DAC mode was intended for. And that animation that you saw, that is the one and only scenario and the only reason we introduced DAC mode in 2010. All right, and I see my lights are flashing, which is perfect because here we are at the end. And I know you probably have a million questions swimming in your head right now. Hopefully some of them are about Exchange and the DAG. And so I will be at the booth later on this afternoon, and also happy to take questions at the microphone or up here if you want. So feel free to ask me any questions that you have before you leave, and hope to see you in the repeat of Tips and Tricks this afternoon.